Well, welcome to a set of lectures on Hume. It's particularly targeted for those of you who are studying history of philosophy from Descartes to Kant, but I hope there will be plenty of interest for those of you who may be postgraduate studying Hume or just here for general interest. Now, last year I gave a set of 8 lectures on Hume's treatise, which were very much focused on the text, going pretty steadily through the first book of the treatise. Those lectures were recorded and can be found online, so I shall be giving you references to that from a website on this set of lectures. That gives me the freedom this year to be a bit more wide-ranging, to focus not just on the treatise, but look at other works of Hume's and indeed other influences on Hume, and to talk more generally about the interpretation of Hume. So the lectures this year will have a very different flavour from last year. I'll mainly be going through focusing on particular topics and discussing how Hume should be understood. That means that a higher proportion of what I say this year will be potentially controversial. I'm not going to shy away from expressing my own opinions on the interpretative matters, but I will of course draw your attention to areas where there are major scholarly debates. My hope is that the two together will enable you both to grapple with the treatise, to see the detail of the text and how that works, but at the same time get a bigger picture and understand how Hume can be seen, what his aims are, how far he achieves them, and so forth. So today I'm going to focus on Hume's historical background and what I take to be his chief argument. How did he get to think about the topics that he did? And in particular, why does the treatise have the character that it does? It's a slightly strange book. It covers a wide range of topics, but it's pretty clear if you look at it that the major part of Hume's interest is in Book 1, Part 3, where he discusses causation, induction, belief, and so forth. Now, the first two books of the treatise were published in January 1739. And later that year, we think probably around September or October of 1739, he wrote an abstract of the treatise, which he published in March 1740. Now, the treatise had been anonymous and the abstract was anonymous too. He wrote it as a sort of puff of the treatise, saying what a good work it is and how people should go and read it. And he focused in the abstract on what he called the chief argument of the treatise. In fact, the very title of the abstract says, in which the chief argument of that work is further illustrated and explained. Now, the chief argument, if we are to take the abstract at its word, is precisely that thread of argument that connects causation, induction, belief, free will. So what I want to do today is present a hypothesis about why Hume might have been motivated in the way that he was. Now, some of this is based on conjecture. On the other hand, I think it's quite plausible conjecture. And whether it's true or not, what it does do is serve to pull together quite a number of threads which you might not see as connected unless it were drawn to your attention. And I think having seen the connections, it makes more sense of why Hume should be interested in the things that he was interested in. So here we go. First, a little bit of very broad historical background. So Hume was born in 1711, in Edinburgh. Now, putting that in context, that's only about 100 years after Galileo had turned his telescope to the sky and basically refuted the Aristotelian view of the world. That was a monumental event, had huge repercussions. We have Bacon in 1620 advocating the empirical method of science very prominently. Descartes, the Meditations, which you probably know, 1641. You've got the Royal Society of London being formed for the promotion of science in 1660. Robert Boyle, one of the founding fathers and most prominent scientists of the time, writing his best-known work in 1661. And then in 1687, we have Newton's Principia, probably the most influential work of science ever written. Absolute work of genius in which he showed how a huge amount could be brought together in a synthesis of mathematical physics. So Hume is not that long after these events, and it's worth thinking about that. We're now looking at Hume. He was born 300 years ago. It's his tercentenary this year, and yet he's only 100 years or so after Galileo. Now, over that time, the mechanical philosophy had become particularly prominent. This was championed in rather different ways by Descartes and by Boyle. So for Descartes, as you probably know, the essence of matter is extension. So Descartes identifies matter with extension. And he sees the properties of matter as following from the fact that it is basically geometrical extension. Boyle, in England, takes a rather different view. Boyle sees matter as not only extended, but also impenetrable. So whereas Descartes had thought that the whole physical world is full of matter, because matter is extended stuff, that's all it is, therefore you can't have extension without matter, Boyle had the theory that you have corpuscles of matter within a void, within emptiness. So his physical theory is fundamentally different from Descartes, but both of them are broadly mechanistic in that they see the physical world as consisting of extended stuff which basically bashes into each other. The explanation of how things work is mechanical in terms of mechanical contact, quite unlike that the Aristotelian theory, which had instead seen physical things as driven by desires, by strivings. Stones fell to the center of the earth because they desired to reach the center of the earth. Now we no longer have that. It's a mechanistic theory of inert matter being pushed around by other bits of inert matter. Now, one of the things that seemed very nice about this theory was that it made physics intelligible. If you think of one billiard ball bashing into another, there's something comfortingly intelligible about that. You see one moving and it communicates the motion to the other. That seems to a scientist much more amenable than the idea that stones are driven by some kind of desire, something that you cannot really get hold of, that you can't measure, and so on. So the kind of science that's opened up by this, the sort of mathematical physics, has this reassuring air of comprehensibility, something we can get our minds around. On the other hand, it opens a skeptical gap. The world, as we perceive it, is very different from the world as it actually is. On Boyle's theory, the world is composed of lots of minute atoms or corpuscles. We don't see it like that at all. So you can see that there's scope for skepticism here. And the skeptical worries were particularly focused by Thomas Hobbes, known as the Monster of Malmesbury because he was such a hated figure. He's claimed as an alumnus by my college, Hertford College, a very great philosopher along with Descartes of the early modern period. He took this the whole way. He wanted to say the only things that exist in the world are material. There's nothing other than the physical world, and the physical world consists entirely of matter. Along with that, he wanted to say that everything in the world is causally determined. If everything consists of material particles, and we are used to material things bashing into each other according to fairly well understood laws, it seems to follow that the universe is going to be a deterministic one. And you might worry then about whether there's any room for free will. Hobbes actually wanted to say that we are free, but being free is simply a matter of being able to do what you want to do. that's entirely compatible with being determined. Hume later would follow him in many ways in that respect. And Hobbes thought that a perfect science would be a demonstrative science. He thought the world was intelligible in this way as a pure mechanism. You've probably heard of Hobbes, even if you've never heard of his materialism, because he's most famous for the book Leviathan, in which he presented a political philosophy advocating absolute sovereignty. He's still very prominent on syllabuses of political philosophy in universities around the world. But in his time, what most worried people was not the political theory, it was the materialism. Now, Hobbes didn't actually overtly deny the existence of God, but clearly his materialism was in significant tension with it. If you deny the existence of immaterial spirits, then God, if he exists, and the angels, if they exist, must be material things. And that's hard to reconcile with any traditional views of God. So it's perhaps not surprising that he was viewed as something of a monster. In 1666, this was the year after the Great Plague, and then there was the Great Fire of London in 1666, his atheism was cited by Parliament as the probable cause. So this was debated in Parliament as to whether Hobbes should be punished for God having had reason to attack London in this way. And his books were burned in Oxford. And various fellows of both Oxford and Cambridge, if they acknowledged any support of Hobbes, typically lost their jobs. And there are some quite amusing documents from the time in which different members of both universities were trying to explain away their support of Hobbes. Now, philosophers lined up to refute Hobbes. Here are some of them. You can see, bearing in mind Leviathan was 1651, you've got a lot of major philosophers there lining up to attack him. And the means of attacking Hobbes was always pretty much the same. Remember, we've got a theory of the physical world which accounts for it as mechanical. So the idea is that physical things are made of corpuscles which basically are bashed around, and they're inert. They don't have the kind of strivings or desires that Aristotle had thought. On the contrary, they are acted upon by external forces and move accordingly. So Newton, for example, when accounting for the motion of the moon around the Earth, instead of supposing that the moon had some sort of desire to move in circles because that imitated the perfection of God, which was the sort of ancient theory and the theory of the medievals, Newton wanted to say, no, the moon just keeps on moving in the same direction at the same speed unless it's acted upon by a force. That force is gravity. And if you suppose that there is this force, which is proportional to the masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distance, lo and behold, you find that you get an orbit. That's why things move as they do. And he wanted to apply exactly the same physical theory to things on Earth as to the moon and the planets. So part of this theory is that matter is inert. It just carries on moving in the same way unless it's acted upon by a force. But we're not inert. We have active powers. We can think. We're conscious. And we can see that that isn't just a passive thing. So the argument against Hobbes, against his materialism, is simply that if we were made of matter, then we would be purely passive as well. But we're not. We have active powers. Therefore, we can't be material. And this, of course, is crucial for defending the notion of an immortal soul. If the soul is to be immortal, if it's to live on after death, then it had better not just be matter. It better not just disappear when our body decays. So the matter is of tremendous theological significance. So we've now come to John Locke. Famous for quite a number of contributions, and we'll be seeing several of them in what follows. So he wrote his Essay Concerning Human Understanding in 1690, massively influential work, dominated the philosophy of the following century. His political philosophy was also extremely influential. Now remember that I said that there was a skeptical potential to the new science. It seemed to suggest that the world that as it is very different from the world how we perceive it. So there's a pressing need to give some account of that. And in the face of people like Hobbes, there's also a pressing need to try to make sense of our place in the universe and the existence of God. So Locke wanted both to provide an account of human knowledge, and antecedent to that, an account of human thought. But he also wanted to defend the traditional doctrines of Christianity. He wrote a work, The Reasonableness of Christianity, for example. Now, we tend to think of him as an empiricist as compared with Descartes, who was a rationalist. But in many ways, they were on the same side. They were both trying to produce an account of human knowledge which fitted within this new world order. But his emphasis is very much on knowledge through experience, what we call empiricism, and probability, rather than the kind of thing that Descartes was trying to do, which was build a priori certainty. Now, the concept of empiricism is a rather slippery one, and I'm not particularly keen, actually, on the idea of dividing the philosophers of the 17th and 18th century into rationalists and empiricists. For a start, there are two quite different kinds of empiricism. So the first one is sometimes called concept empiricism. That is the thought that all our ideas derive from experience. So whatever we think about, the content of our thought has to come from experience. We don't have any innate ideas. So whereas Descartes thought that the idea of God was innate and the idea of extension was innate, so that we could find out about things by investigating our own ideas, even in the absence of relevant experience, Locke wanted to say all of our ideas come entirely from experience. But a quite separate issue is whether any knowledge, all our knowledge comes from experience. You might hold that all our ideas come from experience, but nevertheless, having acquired those ideas, we can know things about them without consulting experience. So the two are separable. So distinguish concept empiricism from knowledge empiricism, which is that all knowledge of the world derives from experience. Now, broadly, Hume is an empiricist in both of those ways, but Locke is not. Locke is a concept empiricist, but he's not a knowledge empiricist. He does think there is, in Kant's terms, some synthetic a priori knowledge. Synthetic meaning about the world, not just a matter of definitions. A priori meaning knowable in advance of experience. As I said, Hume follows Locke in the concept empiricism, but he's also a knowledge empiricist. Let's look, while we're on the topic, look at Hume's version of Locke's concept empiricism. So this is Hume's copy principle. You can see it's coming right in the first section of the treatise, seventh paragraph of the first section of the first book, of the first part of the first book. All our simple ideas in their first appearance are derived from simple impressions, which are correspondent to them and which they exactly represent. Now, although Hume presents this as the first principle of his philosophy, he's taking it pretty straightforwardly from Locke. He acknowledges that in a footnote to the inquiry. This is the inquiry concerning human understanding of 1748. In section two of the inquiry, he goes over some of the material of his theory of ideas that he previously put in the treatise, and there he quite clearly says, essentially what I'm doing when I state this principle, what we now think of as the copy principle, though he didn't call it that, what I'm doing is giving a more accurate version of Locke's empiricism. All the materials of our thought come from experience. And that plays a very large role in Hume's philosophy. Okay. Now back to Locke. I've mentioned that Locke is engaged on a number of different exercises here. He's trying to account for the origin of our ideas. He's trying to account for the possibility of knowledge, or at least probable knowledge, even if not certain knowledge. And amongst that, he's trying to justify a broadly traditional view of God. So, with that in mind, he presents a version of the cosmological argument. Now, the cosmological argument, that's a name that's given to a family of arguments for God's existence, but they all typically take the form of tracing back things to their first cause, and then identifying that first cause as God, one way or another. So, here we have it. This is from the fourth book of the Essay Concerning Human Understanding, chapter 10. There is no truth more evident than that something must be from eternity. This being of all absurdities the greatest, to imagine that pure nothing, the perfect negation and absence of all beings, should ever produce any real existence. Okay. Right. Nothing comes from nothing. If there ever had been nothing, then nothing would ever come about, because you can't get anything from nothing. So there must have been something there from eternity. If then there must be something eternal, let us see what sort of being it must be. It is very obvious that it must necessarily be a cogitative being, a thinking being. For it is as impossible to conceive that ever bare incogitative matter should produce a thinking intelligent being as that nothing should of itself produce matter. Now, that's essentially the same point that I've said lots of philosophers were putting against Hobbes. We know that we can't be matter, we can't be pure material, because matter by itself could never cause thought. And since we are thinking things, we're aware of having that active power, we cannot simply consist of passive, inert matter. And this is a variant on the same kind of argument. Now, Locke wasn't the only person to be presenting this sort of argument. Indeed, as I've shown, a whole load of philosophers came out with rather similar things. Closer to Hume's day, Samuel Clarke was probably the most prominent philosopher. Between Locke and Hume, Samuel Clarke stands out as particularly influential. He became known as a very prominent advocate of the Newtonian philosophy. He had some correspondence with Leibniz, the Leibniz-Clarke correspondence, which some of you will probably have studied if you've done, if you're doing physics and philosophy. More pertinent to Hume is a debate that he had with Anthony Collins, a well-known freethinker, in other words, somebody who was inclined towards what others would have called atheism. Collins wanted to argue that human behavior is subject to necessity just like matter. So he was commonly accused of being a Hobbist, a follower of Thomas Hobbes, because he wanted to say human behavior is just as necessary as billiard balls. And Clarke had a long debate with him about this, which became very well known. And Clarke, just like Locke, gave a version of the cosmological argument. Now, in fact, here I'm not quoting Clarke, I'm quoting Hume. I'm quoting Hume from his Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion. So this is where Demir, who is a participant in the dialogue, who's obviously quite fond of Samuel Clarke, comes out with an argument which is very reminiscent of Clarke's. Whatever exists must have a cause or reason of its existence. What was it then which determined something to exist rather than nothing? Nothing can never produce anything. Again, the same move that Locke made. An infinite succession of causes without any ultimate cause at all is absurd. We must therefore have recourse to a necessarily existent being who carries the reason of his existence in himself. There is consequently such a being, that is, there is a deity. So, there's two different versions of the cosmological argument. There were lots of different ways of elaborating it, ways of going on from showing that if a being carried its own reason of existence in itself, then it would have to have the other godlike attributes. For example, one might appeal to the ontological argument there. But this was, at the time, the most prominent argument for God's existence. Later it got taken over somewhat by the design argument, which is why Hume later in his life put a lot more emphasis on the design argument in his dialogues. Most of the dialogues is focused on that. What I want to do now is turn a bit towards Hume's biography and see how these various themes play out and how we can find clues to the unity of his thought, or at least his chief argument, within these. So first of all, some circumstantial points. James Boswell went and interviewed Hume on his deathbed. Hume died of cancer in 1776. He knew he was dying for a long time. And people were naturally very interested in how this man, who was notoriously thought of as an atheist, not that he'd been very explicit about it, but people were aware that he was much less than wholehearted in any religious beliefs, people were interested in how he would face death, because the traditional view was that religion provided consolation when you died, and that fear of annihilation would be absolutely overwhelming unless you were comforted by religious belief. And Boswell was rather disturbed when Hume told him that he didn't believe in immortality. He didn't deny the possibility of immortality, but he thought it was about as likely as that a piece of coal put into the fire wouldn't be consumed. Now, from our point of view, particularly interesting is what he said about the history of his lack of belief in religion. He never had entertained any belief in religion since he began to read Locke and Clarke. Now, it might be that Hume was applying a touch of humour here. Notice he's not saying since he began to read people like Hobbes or Collins. No, Locke and Clarke. It's the defenders of religion that he's reading, and he's finding their arguments so unsatisfactory that he's ceasing to believe. Now, Locke and Clarke, as we've seen, both advocated the cosmological argument. They were both very strong advocates of the anti-Hobbist argument that matter cannot cause thought. Now, a particularly interesting circumstantial point, along with the Boswell quote, is that if you look at Treatise 133, that's where Hume discusses the causal maxim, the maxim that whatever begins to exist must have a cause of its existence. He discusses that and concludes that it cannot be demonstratively proved. We can't know it for certain. In that section, both Locke and Clarke are identified by footnotes. He discusses arguments, attributes them explicitly to Locke and Clarke. That's actually the only section in any of his works where he refers to both of those philosophers in that way. So what I'm now going to do is go back to Hume's early years, and I'm going to suggest that these various threads come together in an interesting way, a way that suggests that there may well be things in Hume's early life that explain why he was focused in this way on these concerns of Locke and Clarke. So, Hume was born in Edinburgh, as I've said, but in fact his family was based in the village of Chirnside, which is near Berwick. It's about 9 miles from Berwick. And what I've got here is a picture of some of the Chirnside countryside, and that's a sort of interpretation board which was put up this year on the occasion of Hume's tercentenary. This is at the head of a walk. You walk down through the fields, and that leads you to Nine Wells, or as they call it locally, Ninels, which is the house where Hume was brought up. And I want to introduce you to just a few of the figures who were around at that time in Berwickshire and nearby. Well, first of all, a chap called William Dudgeon. Now, he published a work called The State of the Moral World Considered in 1732. Okay, so Hume at that time was 21. He'd been to university, but come back, and was currently living at Nine Wells. And this was a couple of years before he went off to France to write the treatise. He was in France from 1734 to 1737, working on the treatise. So this is the right kind of time. And Dudgeon wrote a work defending what's called optimism, the theory generally associated with Leibniz, famously parodied by Voltaire in the work Candide, the idea that everything that happens in the world happens for the best. And this was connected with necessitarianism, the view that everything that happens happens of necessity, causal determinism. Now, he was attacked by Andrew Baxter, who was a very prominent supporter of Clark. Incidentally, we can get the wrong perspective on this looking back. You know, we tend to think Locke, Berkeley, Hume. Oh, Berkeley must have been a really important philosopher at the time. Well, actually, Baxter's works went through numerous editions before Berkeley's had had a second edition. So Baxter was, not only was he local for Hume, but he was actually a more prominent philosopher at the time than Berkeley in most circles. And he, not only did he attack Dudgeon quite prominently, he also may have been behind attacks on Hume in 1745. So this was 6 years after Hume had written the treatise. He applied for a chair at Edinburgh, and a pamphlet was written criticising Hume. And Hume wrote a response called The Letter from a Gentleman to His Friend in Edinburgh. And it's commonly thought that some of the passages in that are alluding to Baxter's work. So again, it's not just a circumstantial connection. We've got quite a deep connection here. So Baxter published this Inquiry into the Nature of the Human Soul in 1733. You can see it went through a number of editions. It's best known now because he attacked Berkeley, amongst others. But what I want to draw your attention to is a prosecution that occurred at Chirnside. So Chirnside, the village where Hume grew up, where George Hume, his uncle, was minister. Notice, by the way, that Hume, for the Scots, is spelt H-O-M-E. Hume changed his name to H-U-M-E when he came down to Bristol in 1734. He was fed up with the English mispronouncing his name. So George Hume, spelt Home, was David Hume's uncle. So he was minister at Chirnside. And William Dudgeon, this freethinker, was prosecuted on these counts. First, that he denies and destroys all distinction and difference between moral good and evil, or else makes God the author of evil and refers all evil to the imperfection of creatures. Okay, if everything that happens happens of necessity, then if evil happens, God's responsible for it because he set the whole thing in train. Second, that he denies the punishment of another life, or that God punishes men for sin in this life, yea, that man is accountable. Okay, now sadly we do not have any evidence, any written evidence, whatever, only this circumstantial evidence, that Hume knew anything about Dudgeon or his prosecution. But given that they were so close together, it seems extremely likely that he would have done. Regarding Andrew Baxter, we have further evidence because of Henry Hume, Lord Kames. Now, he was another member of the Hume family, lived nearby. He was older than Hume, and he rather took Hume under his wing when Hume went to Edinburgh University. Hume went up to Edinburgh University, actually, he was still 10 at the time. He went up with his brother, who was 2 years older. And when there, Henry Hume, who at the time was plain Henry Hume, before he'd been elevated to the bar and became Lord Kames, he looked after quite a number of younger students. He seems to have enjoyed cultivating their philosophical interests and so on. So he had quite a lot of influence on David Hume. Now, he corresponded with Andrew Baxter and criticised him, and he had a particular interest in causation. In fact, we've got letters from him or from other people describing his interest in that way. He is said to have said to David Hume that David should beat his head into Kames's head. He should beat his book into Kames's head so that he could really understand what the treatise was about. And the particular focus there was causation. So he and David Hume shared that interest, and Kames may have played a large part in generating that interest. Now let's look at what are called Hume's early memoranda. So this is a page here. You can see the word philosophy written at the top. So these are notes written by Hume, probably reading notes. So he was reading through various works, and he was making notes to inform his later thinking. And we don't actually know when they were written. There's been some debate about this. They used to be thought to predate the treatise. I think the current thinking is probably that some of them at least come after the treatise, reading prior to further works, his essays and so forth. But the philosophical notes, at any rate, show Hume's intense interest in the causal maxim, necessity, free will, and its implications for God's existence and the problem of evil. All those issues that we have seen turning up so far in Locke, Clarke, Baxter, Dudgeon, and so forth. So here are three examples of the notes that Hume is making in his early memoranda. Liberty not a proper solution of moral ill, because it might have been bound down by motives like those of saints and angels. What does that mean? Well, the big defense to the problem of evil, right? The problem of evil, if there's a wonderfully good God, a perfectly good God, why is there so much evil in the world? The free will defense of theism, is to say, God isn't responsible for that because free agents bring about the evil. Free human beings do evil things, you know, like Adam, urged on by Eve, urged on by the serpent, eats the apple. Free action. God is not responsible for that because it's free. And maybe there are free demons as well, Satan and his cohorts. So God cannot be held responsible for what they do. That's the free will defense. What Hume is pointing out here is, hang on a minute, if a free agent only ever wants to do good things, then you can have free agents without any evil. Think about the angels, right? The angels are supposed to be good. God himself, is he a free agent? Well, surely as free as any agent can be. And yet God is supposed to do all sorts of things. They're perfectly good. So it looks like freedom is compatible with doing good things all the time. So liberty is not a proper solution of moral ill, because it might have been bound down by motives like those of saints and angels. We could have been free, but been given perfectly good motives. Why didn't God do that? Did God give liberty to please men themselves, but men are as well pleased to be determined to good? In other words, people who want to do good are quite happy to do good. God could have prevented all abuses of liberty without taking away liberty, therefore liberty no solution of difficulties. So the point I want to make here is that we've got these memoranda, not large numbers of them, okay? And quite a significant proportion of them are focused on these issues where, if you like, causation, free will meet theology. Now let's go back to Locke's empiricism. I've mentioned that Hume copied Locke in this. All ideas, according to Hume, are derived from impressions. That is, every thought that we have is copied from a sensation or a feeling. And he takes this to be the best way of expressing Locke's empiricism, that all of our ideas are derived from experience. Okay, now, these various things that we've been thinking about, like the cosmological argument, you know, everything that comes into existence must have a cause, or the issue of free will and determinism, is everything that we do caused or necessitated? The issue of causal necessity is at the heart of that. And I suspect that Hume, when he thought about things like the debate between Clark and Collins, particularly, over the nature of free will, would very naturally have been led to ask, okay, what does causal necessity amount to? Because you've got Clark and Collins debating about the nature of necessity and whether the same necessity applies to physical things as applies to the mind. And you've got all these other issues that flow from that. Now, put yourself in the position of a young man very influenced by Locke, all right? You're convinced that all ideas derive from experience. Here you've got a crucially important idea, the idea of causal necessity, and you think to yourself, well, let's take a look at how this idea is derived from experience. And he looks at Locke's account and he finds that it's inadequate, which it is. Incidentally, the very same chapter where Locke discusses the idea of power or necessary connection, he also discusses free will. So Hume, here we've got a very focused area that seems to have been very much engaging Hume, and I'm suggesting that if he was looking there, that could explain where his chief argument comes from. Now, I mentioned at the beginning that the abstract of the treatise identifies this as the chief argument of the treatise. But in the treatise itself, the whole thing is orientated around the search for the idea of cause. That's not the case, incidentally, in the abstract and in the inquiry. So I think that the treatise reveals, as it were, the way in which Hume came to this. I think by thinking about this nexus of problems, he was asking about the origin of this idea. That is what we see in the treatise. And then when he came to think more about it, he realized that wasn't quite so central and approached things in a different direction. So let's see how he goes in the treatise. He starts by identifying the components of the idea of causation. So if you go to treatise 132, you'll see that. 136 is the discussion of induction. That's where he identifies constant conjunction as an important theme. We're going to be coming back to this later, okay, in detail. For now, I'm just going through very quickly. We then get a lot of discussion of belief and probability, which is a bit of a detour. And it's only in 1314 that he comes back to the original question that he'd been asking. What is the origin of our idea of causal necessity? So that's the discussion of the idea of necessary connection. Let's just take a very quick look at how that goes. Again, we'll be coming back to this. He starts off by saying that all these terms, efficacy, agency, power, force, energy, necessity, connection, productive quality, are all nearly synonymous. So when he's looking for the idea of necessary connection, it's also the idea of power, causal power. He's looking for the fundamental idea that lies behind all these various concepts. So you can see it's going to underlie the causal maxim. It's also going to underlie discussions of free will and determinism. And here's how he refutes Locke. I believe the most general and most popular explication of this matter is to say that finding from experience that there are several new productions in matter, such as the motions and variations of body, and concluding that there must somewhere be a power capable of producing them, we arrive at last by this reasoning at the idea of power and efficacy. But to be convinced that this explication is more popular than philosophical, we need but reflect on two very obvious principles. First, that reason alone can never give rise to any original idea. I'm not going to go on to the second. That's enough. And in the inquiry, that's again where Hume focuses. And there he quite explicitly identifies Locke as the target. So Locke has failed, right? Locke set out to explain the origin of all our ideas from experience. Here is Locke's explanation of the idea of power. Right? We see that things change in systematic ways, and therefore we think there must be a power capable of creating them. Hang on, Locke. Where did that idea come from? Power. You haven't explained where that idea came from. You've used it in your explanation, but you haven't explained its origin. That won't do. So once he noticed this inadequacy of Locke's account, lying right at the heart of this bundle of important philosophical issues, I suspect that's what set Hume going. And he thought, let me get to the bottom of this. Let me identify the real source of this key idea of power or necessary connection. And off he goes. And this is quite well known. Again, we'll be coming back to this in detail, so I'm going to just go pretty quickly through it here. You can't find powers in any single instances. You see one billiard ball bashing into another and the other one moves. You get various sensory impressions. You don't see the power. Okay. You find various things happening in your mind. One thing follows another. But you don't perceive the power. Nor can you get a general idea of power from any of these. Hume has a reason for that, given his theory of general ideas. In order to find the genuine origin of the idea of power, you have to turn to repeated instances. When we see A followed by B again and again, we see an A, we find ourselves inferring a B. So we immediately conceive a connection between the two things and draw an inference from one to another. This multiplicity of resembling instances, therefore, constitutes the very essence of power or connection and is the source from which the idea of it arises. So Hume is very famously finds the source of the idea of power or necessary connection in repeated instances of one thing following another and in our tendency to draw inferences accordingly. Now, I'm not going to go into the detail of that now. We'll be coming back to this in a later lecture. But famously, he comes to the conclusion, or he expresses his conclusion, in terms of necessity being in the mind, not in objects. It's very controversial how this should be elucidated. And he, again famously, and with endless source of confusion to his interpreters, he gives two definitions of causation, and two definitions correspondingly of necessary connection, but that comes later. There may two definitions be given of this relation, which are only different by their presenting a different view of the same object. We may define a cause to be an object precedent and contiguous to another, and where all the objects resembling the former are placed in like relations of precedency and contiguity to those objects which resemble the latter. If this definition be esteemed defective, because drawn from objects foreign to the cause, we may substitute this other definition in its place, viz., a cause is an object precedent and contiguous to another, and so united with it that the idea of the one determines the mind to form the idea of the other, and the impression of the one to form a more lively idea of the other. So again, plenty of scope for debate about what exactly he means. The crucial point is he's saying this is all there is to our idea of causation, either constant conjunction or the inference of the mind. Then we find later in the treatise, this is in book two, but what I'm quoting here is from the abstract of the treatise, he applies these definitions to the question of liberty and necessity. And he argues that exactly the same kind of necessity is applicable in the mind as in physical objects. How does he know that? Well, because he's just defined causal necessity. He's given these two definitions. That's all we can understand by it. And his conclusion is that since both of those definitions apply equally to the moral world, the world of human behaviour, it follows that exactly the same kind of causal necessity applies to human behaviour as it does to billiard balls. So here we see a direct application of his analysis of the idea of cause to one of these key issues that he's been that I have argued motivated him. Now, the quotation at the bottom here is taken from his discussion in the treatise of Liberty and Necessity. But look at the quote at the top. All objects which are found to be constantly conjoined are upon that account only to be regarded as causes and effects. The constant conjunction of objects constitutes the very essence of cause and effect. Here he is applying his definition of causation. Yes, there are two parts to that definition, and you might think this is a bit odd because he seems to have forgotten about the inference of the mind here. But this is what he says. And he is applying this to the famous argument against Hobbes, all right? Hobbes had said that we are just material. Everyone argued against Hobbes. No, no, that can't be, because matter can't cause thought, right? Pure motion of matter couldn't possibly cause thought because they're so different. Here's this argument against Hobbes, and yet nothing in the world is more easy to refute it than to refute it. We need only to reflect on what has been proved at large, that to consider the matter a priori, anything may produce anything, and we shall never discover a reason why any object may or may not be the cause of any other, however great or however little the resemblance may be between them. Anything can cause anything, because all you need in order to have a causal relation is a constant conjunction. And anything can be constantly conjoined with anything else. So the only way you can find out what causes what is by experience, by seeing what is constantly conjoined. So there's an end of a priori science. And we find by experience that motion of matter and thought are constantly conjoined, which being all the circumstances that enter into the idea of cause and effect, we may certainly conclude that motion may be and actually is the cause of thought and perception. As the constant conjunction of object constitutes the very essence of cause and effect, matter and motion may often be regarded as the causes of thought as far as we have any notion of that relation. So what you have here is Hume applying his analysis of the idea of cause, which he's looked for the origin of that idea in accordance with Lockean principles. All our ideas are derived from experience. He's followed that prescription. He's looked for the origin in experience of our idea of cause. And now he's applied it, very importantly, in two crucial areas. Free will and necessity. Right, free will and determinism. He said, actually, that idea of causal necessity applies just as much to human behaviour as it does to billiard balls. We are as causally determined as billiard balls. Incidentally, like Hobbes, he doesn't think that undermines our freedom. Secondly, he's arguing it to defend the materialists, to say there's no reason in principle why motion of matter should not cause thought. So taken together, his argument about causation, it refutes the cosmological argument, because the cosmological argument's based on the principle that everything must have a cause. Hume's analysis undermines that. He refutes the anti-materialist arguments. He refutes the free will theodicy, because he's going to say that because human behavior is completely determined, that is completely compatible with our being free. So if we then go and do evil things, God is responsible just as much as we are, because God set the whole thing in motion. It refutes, or aims to refute, a prioristic causal metaphysics in general. As we've seen, Hume wants to say that because constant conjunction is the essence of causation, anything could cause anything. We cannot know a priori what will be constantly conjoined with what. At the same time, it supports empirical science. Okay? The only way to find out what causes what is to use experience. Well, that's what we better do then. And it crucially supports the extension of causal science into the moral realm. So Hume becomes a champion of moral science, causal moral science, looking for the causes, the systematic causes of human behaviour. So the vision we get here is not by any means completely sceptical. You can see why Hume is viewed as a sceptic, because he's attacking a lot of cherished beliefs. But at the same time, there's a very constructive purpose to replace the kind of a prioristic theological science that came before with an empirical science which has no dependence on religion. That's it for today.